Bibles with me and turn to Acts chapter 22. Acts chapter 22, picking up where we left off a couple of weeks ago. It was good to have Brother Caleb Reed, evangelist, with us last Sunday. I'm glad to be back in the book of Acts. Just about 7 weeks from today, 6 or 7 weeks from today, we will be celebrating our church's 29th anniversary. Hard to believe. And obviously, we moved into this building on our 10th anniversary, so this will be the 19th year we've been in this building. We are so close to having the mortgage paid off. I mean, we are so close. We will make another payment in August, September. That'll leave around $16,000. And so, can you figure out what do you think our goal is going to be for Sunday, September 15th? I would love to see that we pay off our mortgage by the offering on that day. And so that's what I'm going to pray for. That's what I'm going to set as our goal, around $16,750. That is not an impossibility. I know the Lord can do that. And so I would encourage you to be praying toward that. You know, the Lord sent us, Juanita and I, and two boys at the time, Benjamin and Barak, to Greeley in 1995 to plant this church. And he provided for us, step by step. There were times when we wondered, how are we going to make it? As I've mentioned before, we came out here with 55% of our support, just a little over half of our support. And by God's grace and by God's providence, the Lord has provided all along the way. He has also provided for our church, for you. He has provided for this church through you, through every person the Lord has brought here. God has provided for this church. The getting this land was a miracle. Building on this 10 years into it, I thought it was going to happen in 5, but 10 years into it is of the Lord's doing. Lord willing, paying this off, that's of the Lord's doing. The Lord has provided. The word provided is related to the word provision, and there's two words in the one word provision. There is the prefix is pro, which means before, and then you've got the word vision. And provision has to do with seeing before, to see ahead of time. And I like to think of provision with those two words, to see before. So the word provision means a preparatory action or measure. And obviously it's closely related with the word providence. Do you believe in the providence of God?
Amen.
The word providence has the idea, just in its first definition in the dictionary, care or preparation in advance, foresight. God knows what's going to happen. Knowing what's going to occur, he takes care of us with what is about to happen. No greater example than what took place with the providence of God a week ago last night in Butler, Pennsylvania. Listen, there are many who now believe that was an act of God. I've watched that video. All of us have probably seen the video multiple times, and I have gone through it multiple times, of former President Trump there in Butler, Pennsylvania, and I've watched and watched and watched it. How that by God's grace, he turned to look at the screen, and he talked about this in a Republican National Convention, and he had his face turned just a little bit this way slightly, and just as he turned, the bullet whizzed by. Right through his ear. That was by God's grace. And you said, wow, that's really neat to see. Do you realize that God's providence is at work through every person in here?
Amen.
There were some people who said, oh, he was lucky. That is not luck. I don't believe the word luck belongs in a Christian's vocabulary.
Amen.
It was God's foresight, God's working. His first post on Truth Social, which is his alternative to what used to be called Twitter or X, he said this: it was God alone who prevented the unthinkable from happening. So even he recognizes that it was the Lord. There's a book that I read some years ago, and in chapter 2 of this particular book, there's a question. The chapter heading is, "What is Providence?" It's in a book, interestingly enough, called Not by Chance. That's the title of the book by Leighton Talbert. And under that chapter 2, What is Providence?, he quotes a man by the name of Leonard Woods, who said, "The doctrine of divine providence is that all things are sustained, directed, and controlled by God." And Talbert makes this statement: providence involves God's capacity to see and consequently to act beforehand. What would be the antonym to providence? He even lists this in his book. The antonym to providence is coincidence. Now, we've all used that word before. Oh, what a coincidence! Oh, what a coincidence! Well, the synonyms to coincidence are luck, fate, fluke, chance, happenstance, and accident. It is no accident that it is you, this particular crowd, in this audience today. There's no accident that you're here. You say, "Well, I chose to come." You did. Just like you chose to be saved. But at the same time, those who are walking in obedience with God are here because you chose to be here to obey Him. Others are here because perhaps you had nothing else to do. Perhaps you were invited, but you maybe reluctantly chose to be here today. That's in many cases what kids choose. They were made to be here. Talbert quotes some theologians who give their definitions of providence. And in their lengthy quotes, and I'm not going to give you their lengthy quotes, I'm going to give you a statement from each of their quotes that I saw to be a consistent concept in all of their quotes. So here's a theologian by the name of Charles Hodge, and he makes this particular, he includes this concept in his definition. It supposes an end to be attained. God's providence supposes an end to be attained. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia puts it this way: to accomplish, God's providence accomplishes the ends for which we are created. Erickson, within the purposes of God. Packer, for His own glory. And on, you'll see in these definitions of providence that God's providence is not just that He sees beforehand, but that He sees beforehand to accomplish His glory, His purposes, and to have His end take place. That's God's providence. And the thing is you can either be a part of it by walking in obedience with Him, or you can resist it, as many do. So you can either choose to obey Him or choose to disobey. For example, there's an interesting word used in Romans 13, 14 that says, "And make not provision for the flesh." You can provide in advance for you to sin. Or you can provide in advance to obey. And that's why the Apostle Paul says there, do not provide for the flesh. Do not ahead of time make way to accomplish the lusts of the flesh. Ahead of time, choose to obey. So you can either choose to obey him or choose to disobey. Some people take part in God's providence willingly, consciously obedient. And that tends to happiness because you're aligned with God's purposes and you anticipate reward, gold, silver, and precious stones. Because your whole motive and what you do in this life is for God's glory, to his end, gold, silver, precious stones. Others, even unbelievers, the disobedient, unknowingly take part in God's providence. Now think about it. The shooter was taking place in God's providence. Disobediently. You say, how does that work? Don't know. Can't figure that out. I leave that to God. But others take part in God's providence unwillingly or unknowingly. And I say unwillingly because they do so kicking and screaming. Those, perhaps, to use this as an illustration, who are here this morning but didn't want to be here, kicking and screaming. Well, they may also anticipate a reward. If they're Christians, wood, hay, and stubble. Nothing to show for it. Here in Acts chapter 22, we have looked almost exhaustively at Paul's defense before this Jewish mob. Remember the mob in chapter 21 who are so against him and what they supposed he had done that they are about to kill him, but the soldiers have to carry him probably upon their shoulders to get him away from the crowd, and they're going to take him away to the castle or the headquarters. This is in chapter 21, and they're bearing him up upon themselves to save him from the crowd. And Paul gives his testimony in verses 1 through 21, his defense. He starts with his credibility in verses 1 through 5. He talks about his conversion, God's direct confrontation of Saul in verses 6 to 10. And then he talks about the commission that God gave him. This is God's direct answer to Saul in verses 11 to 21. But all of this is in response to this Jewish mob, this uprising, and their whole uprising. The whole reason they are up in arms, so to speak, is not based upon a fact. It's based upon a supposition. In fact, that supposition is given in verse 29 of chapter 21. Whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. It was all based upon a supposition. You see, these Asiatic Jews, these Jews from Asia, thought that just because they kept on seeing Trophimus with Paul in the city, and Trophimus was a Gentile, it must also be true that he led those Gentiles into the temple. They supposed it. Now, this afternoon, I'm going to be talking about that word supposed. And the problem with supposing, and this causes a problem here. This supposition, and I get this, chapter 21, verse 29, the supposition that they make there, that he had brought a Gentile into the temple, is what the rest of the book of Acts is all about. He's got to defend himself from what they are supposing there. In verse 29, what Jesus Christ had told a reluctant Ananias in chapter 9 and verse 15 is that Paul would be a chosen vessel to bear my name before the kings and Gentiles. And that's fulfilled at the end of the book of Acts. But I want you to see something this morning. Because Paul obeys the commission given to him by God, he enjoys God's providential care. Providence. You know, the founders of our nation talked a lot about God's providence. I forgot to bring my $1 bill here. You have a, anybody have a dollar bill? We're not taking an offering. You have a dollar bill in your wallet, take it out. Seriously, take it out. Get your, it's got to be a $1 bill. Take it out, look at it. Go to the back of that $1 bill. There you will see the great seal of the United States of America. Look on the back. Look at the seal. And you're going to see that I. That I that people say, oh, that's related to the Masonic, you know, the Masons and so. It is not. You all see it? Look at the seal. You see a pyramid that's cut off. It's not really cut off, it's just not finished. And that has to do with, you know, the 13 colonies, there's 13 layers of bricks in that seal. And those 13 layers stand for, what do you think? The 13 colonies, but the pyramid is not complete. They knew the nation would grow. But the whole point is that above that little pyramid, what they call a truncated pyramid, is an eye in a triangle. And it stands for the providence of God. Did you know that our founders believed that God was in the founding of our nation? The providence of God. And Paul here, who is obeying the commission given to him by the Lord Jesus Christ, also enjoys God's providential care. I put it this way, God provides for those he commissions. As you obey the great commission and then the particular commission that God has given you, he'll take care of you. It may not be in the way you think. Because we often think, well, if God takes care of me, that means everything's smooth sailing. Not necessarily. But God takes care of you to fulfill his end, to fulfill his purposes. I preached on your particular commission, but let me ask you again, do you believe that you have a particular commission given to you by God? You have the Great Commission. Every believer has the Great Commission. There is a particular one. Paul had this Great Commission just like all of us do. Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, Matthew 28, 19 and 20, Mark chapter 16, go into all the world, preach the gospel, that's the Great Commission. What was his particular commission? It's found in 22 verse 21, the Lord said to him, depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the Gentiles. That was his particular commission. He became the apostle to the Gentiles. Who was the apostle to the Jews? Peter was. Paul to the Gentiles. That doesn't mean he avoided the Jews. He says in Romans chapter 1, to the Jew first, but also to the Gentile. God had called him in his particular commission to the Gentiles. Do you have a particular commission? I believe every Christian does. I don't know what my particular commission is. I'll tell you what your particular commission is. It's where you work to reach the people right where you live. That's your particular commission. You say, well, the Lord has said, all Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the uttermost part of the earth in Acts 1:8. That's true. This is your Jerusalem. We can also support those other areas through missions. God provides for those he commissions. The question is, are you obeying his particular commission for you? I'm right now in my devotions reading in the book of Ezra. And as I was reading yesterday, I found this in chapter 8, verses 22, and again in 31, where Ezra says this, the hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him. Do you believe that the hand of the Lord is upon you for good if you seek him? And then he says this in verse 31 as a matter of testimony. And the hand of our God was upon us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and of such as lay in wait by the way. God provided protection for those who obeyed his commission. So in this passage that I'm going to read here in just a moment, Paul enjoys the providential care of God and how God protects him. Begin reading with me, following along as I read chapter 22 and verse 22. And they gave him audience unto this word, and then lifted up their voices and said, Away with such a fellow from the earth, for it is not fit that he should live. And as they cried out and cast off their clothes and threw dust into the air, the chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle, and bade that he should be examined by scourging. You say, Pastor, it's bade. It's not. It's bad. Look it up in a dictionary. And bade that he be examined by scourging. It means said. They said that he should be examined. That he might know wherefore they cried so against him. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said unto the centurion that stood by, Is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned? When the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief captain, saying, Take heed what thou doest, for this man is a Roman. Then the chief captain came and said unto him, Tell me, art thou a Roman? He said, Yea. And the chief captain answered, With a great sum obtained I this freedom. And Paul said, But I was born free, or I was freeborn. 29. Then straightway they departed from him, which should have examined him. And the chief captain also was afraid after he knew that he was a Roman, and because he had bound him. On the morrow, because he would have known of the certainty whereof he was accused of the Jews, he loosed him from his bands and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear, and brought Paul down and set him before them. In this passage, I repeat, Paul enjoys the providential care of God in how God protects him. So I want you to see, first of all, in verses 22 and 23, his protection from the crowd. His protection from the crowd. Look in verse 22, because in verse 22, you're going to see their intense hatred expressed audibly. Again, they lifted up their voices and they say, Away with this man. It is not fit that he should live. But it also said in verse 22, they had kept on listening until he used a certain word. What was that word? Go back to verse 21. What is the word that he said that got them all up in arms again? Gentiles. Gentiles. He used them in a favorable way, that God would send someone to the Gentiles. The last Hebrew that God had sent to the Gentiles did so only after being swallowed by a big fish. Who was that, kids? Who got swallowed by a big fish, kids? Okay, big kids. Jonah. He's not going to go to the Gentiles. And that is the Jonah mentality here, that attitude toward the Gentiles. Notice that these people, this mob, have no answer to the content of his defense. They respond to one word. By the way, doesn't that sound kind of like the mobs today? They really have no answer. I love watching these man on the street interviews where somebody goes and interviews these people. So why are you here protesting? They can't express themselves. That's the mob. They're just there because everybody else is there screaming and shouting and throwing things into the air. They can't give a reasonable explanation. Nothing logical. And these people cannot respond to his defense. All they can say is, you said the word Gentiles. And they try to nail him on that. Away with such a one. Away from you, not just from the temple or even from Jerusalem, but away from this earth. Kill him. Why? He used the word Gentile. Right after he had supposedly brought a Gentile into the temple, there's their intense hatred expressed audibly. But interestingly enough, in verse 23, you see their intense hatred expressed visually. And there's three participles in verse 23. Look at verse 23 as I read you these three participles, as they would literally be translated. Crying out, casting off, and throwing. It's like A.T. Robertson said, a Greek scholar, these present participles give a lively picture of the uncontrolled excitement of the mob in their spasm of wild rage. So to emphasize their declaration in verse 22 that Paul is not fit to live, in verse 23 they throw a hissy fit. This hissy fit in verse 23 is personal. They throw off their outer garments. Literally, they take their outer garments and throw them into the air. So it's personal. But they also do something aerial. They throw dust into the air with their clothing. Again, this is how ungodly mobs act when there's no answer that they can give. Instead of putting forth someone to debate the Apostle Paul, they just start screaming and acting like spoiled, rotten children to try to get you to do what they want you to do. And that's the modus operandi of unbelieving Jews and all unbelievers. I mean, when you look at what's happening in our country today, people just keep throwing hissy fits. Because they don't want to debate anything. They just want to start screaming in rage because you said something, you did something they disagree with. That all comes, I think those people do read their Bibles. Not really. But they do what happens in the book of Acts time and time and time and time again. The chief captain, in verse 24, responds to these three participles. By the way, the chief captain is, in the Greek, it's the word kiliarch. And that's an English word too, kiliarch. A kiliarch is a commander of 1,000. That's the chief captain. So I'm going to start using the word kiliarch when you see the word chief captain here as we continue on. These people want Paul dead. And yet, God's providence protects him from the crowd. How? God uses soldiers. Chapter 21, verses 35, verse 37, they take him upon the steps as they head into the headquarters, that is, into Antonia, into the castle, as it's called in the King James. And now in 24, they go into the headquarters. Then the chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle. And here we now read of Paul's citizenship and how that became what God used to protect him. And so we see the protection from the crowd. But now, this is an interesting point. I want you to understand why I call it this. Verses 24 to 30 is what I call protection from / by the kiliarch. If you've got a copy of the outline, you're going to see that. But if you don't have a copy of the outline, I'm going to have to repeat that so you get this. In verses 24 to 30, we see the protection, God's providential protection from the kiliarch that transfers or turns into protection by the kiliarch that God at first has to protect him from. I feel for this kiliarch. His name is given. We know his name. Look at chapter 23 and verse 26 in my Bible. It's right across the page. His name is Claudius Lysias. Claudius Lysias, 23:26 of Acts. And I feel for him because he's just trying to do his job. And as we look at these next verses, his job is to know for certain what has taken place. To know why these Jews, why this mob is so upset. His job is to know for certain why they're doing this for the sake of justice. But he's got to get information. He's got to know. So look at verse 24, and you'll notice the words, that he might know. You'll see those same words used in a different way in verse 29. After he knew. And again in verse 30. He would have known. That made for a very simple outline. And it really does follow what I believe Luke is trying to communicate here. Look at verse 24. What the kiliarch might know for certain. And the word know here is a different word. It has a prefix that has to mean, that has to do with, he wants to know for certain. He wants to know exactly what's true. Understand something. Paul had given his defense here in chapter 22 in what language? Does anybody remember? Go back to chapter 22, look at verse 1. Tell me, what language is he speaking in chapter 22? Hebrew or Aramaic. As far as we know, the Kiliarch, his centurions, and the soldiers did not understand it. So, the Kiliarch does not understand, he did not hear Paul's defense. It was spoken in Aramaic. And the Kiliarch is confused why these people are so adamantly opposed to Paul. He is so confused and so bothered by this that he prepares to find out exactly what their reason was by beating him. Look at verse 24 again. And bad that he should be examined by scourging, that he might know, I add, for certain, wherefore they cried so against him. One of the commentators pointed this out. Why didn't the Kiliarch, let's say you're the mob, okay? You're the mob. And you're all screaming and yelling at me, and here's the Kiliarch standing beside me. And you're ready to nail me. This commentator said, why doesn't the Kiliarch find one of the most vociferous, why doesn't he single somebody out of the crowd and say, you get up here and you tell me what's going on here? And if you don't tell me, I'm going to do with you what I'm about to do to this man. Now, wouldn't that make sense? Who's the troublemaker? Is it Paul or is it the mob? Well, who's threatening murder? Paul? No, the mob is. And yet, who's he about to beat? Yeah. Again, do you see that happening today? Yeah. So he's ready to scourge him. Let me describe to you what scourging is. A scourge was a fearful instrument of torture consisting of leather thongs, leather straps. Each one of those thongs was weighted with rough pieces of metal or bone and attached to a wooden handle. Two soldiers, one on each side with his scourge, would alternately strike the man. And that bone on those thongs or those pieces of metal would dig into the skin, and when they pulled it back, it would rip the flesh open. People would confess real quickly. That's what they're about to do to Paul. And somebody said that if a man did not actually die under the scourge, which frequently happened, he would certainly be crippled for life. That's what Paul is facing here. By the way, the same thing was used on Jesus, Matthew 27, 26, to the point where he could not carry his cross. Kiliarch wants to know for certain that he might know what is going on here. Verses 25 to 29, we see what the Kiliarch came to know for certain. He does find something out for certain. And we see in verses 25 and 26 what the Kiliarch came to know for certain from his centurion. This starts off with verse 25, Paul's polite question. The word polite was used by a commentator, Dr. Custer. He noted how this man was, how Paul was so polite to this killer. Wait, folks, he's about to be scourged. And he asks politely a question. It says in verse 25, and as they bound him with thongs, literally, that phrase means this, as they stretched him out with straps. You see what's happening? To constrain their victim and to maximize the pain and the damage, they would stretch him out so that his skin would be tight. And as they're doing this, Paul speaks up. Now, he could have just endured this. He could have just said, okay, here goes, and grit his teeth. But he questions the lawfulness of what they are about to do even by binding him. Verse 29 says they should not have even bound him with what he's about to ask. And I want you to note, he does this politely. He doesn't yell, "I'm a Roman. You can't do this to me." He doesn't appeal to the authorities to have mercy. He doesn't appeal to the soldiers. He appeals to the law. He stands up for his rights as a Roman citizen. That's what he says there. Is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned? Literally, without hearing my case. Can you do this without hearing my case? A Roman? I say again right here that God in his providence prepared Paul for this day. By allowing him to be a Roman citizen. Paul used what God had in his providence provided. Does anybody here have certain rights in a certain country that give you all kinds of freedom? Anybody? Folks, you live in America. It is unlawful for someone to stop you from saying what you want to say. It is unlawful for authorities to come in here and say, "You can't assemble here today because of COVID." I brought my little thing up here that Paul made that we hung outside the church during COVID. Remember this? The First Amendment to the Constitution. Why am I showing you this? Because it's the same thing that the Apostle Paul did. He stood up for his rights as a Roman. Is it lawful for you to do this? And this statement in the form of a question for anybody who would try to come in and shut us down was, you can't do that. Is it lawful for you to do that? When the law very clearly states that you can't? Paul had his rights as a Roman citizen. By the way, rights include responsibilities. And you have rights, but yes, you have responsibilities also to vote, to pay your taxes, to serve in the military if necessary. So there we see Paul's polite question. Then look at the centurion's pointed admonition in verse 26. When the centurion heard that, when he heard that Paul says, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned?" he went and told the chief captain. And so then he admonishes the Kiliarch with this pointed admonition. To the Kiliarch he says, "Take heed what thou doest." Now, literally, that's not a statement as it appears to be. It's actually an urgent question. Here's a literal translation. What are you about to be doing? Now, in defense of the centurion, in defense of the Kiliarch, they did not know who they had in their possession. They did not know that he was a Roman citizen. Paul did not state the fact that he was a Roman. He simply asked a question, "Is it lawful for you to do this to a Roman uncondemned?" And so we saw what the Kiliarch came to know from his centurion. Now we see in verses 27 and 29 what he comes to know for certain from his captive, from the Apostle Paul. Look at the Kiliarch's question in verse 27. "Tell me, art thou a Roman?" Literally, it's emphatic. "Are you a Roman?" He's incredulous. "Are you a Roman?" And Paul gives this long dissertation about his citizenship. Do you see his long dissertation? What is his dissertation composed of? What word? Yes. Let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. There's his question in verse 27. Then, look at the Kiliarch's complaint in verse 28. The Kiliarch, or the chief captain, answered, "With a great sum I obtained this freedom." That's how the Kiliarch responds to Paul's yes. There was a time in the Roman Empire that if you paid enough money, you could purchase your citizenship from a corrupt person who was in charge, who was lining their pockets. In this case, there's evidence that Claudius's wife was selling citizenship to line her pockets. Is that what happened with this Kiliarch here, Claudius Lysias? Claudius, named his Roman name, Claudius, named after the emperor, Lysias, his Greek name. And so he thought that Paul too probably bought his citizenship, but here's a contrast. Now we learn more about God's providence. Even before Paul was saved, even before Paul was saved on the road to Damascus, he was born into a certain kind of a home where they were free. To the Kiliarch's complaint, he says, "But I was," and you'll notice the word "free" is in italics, so it doesn't really appear there. To the Kiliarch's complaint, Paul says, "But I was born," and you can fill in the blank, "I was born a Roman." A.T. Robertson said perhaps one of his ancestors had obtained the citizenship as a reward for distinguished service. F.F. Bruce suggests that it might have been for services like tent making. To Pompey, when he moved his army through the area in 64 B.C., where they would honor somebody who had helped the army, perhaps Paul being a tent maker, coming from a tent maker's family, they made tents for these Roman soldiers, and they conferred upon them the right of Roman citizenship. We don't know. But somehow he has Roman citizenship from birth, which means that his ancestors, either his father, grandfather, or somebody, had obtained that citizenship. And as the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia puts it, his Roman citizenship availed throughout the Roman world and secured for him everywhere certain great immunities and rights, such as exemption from shameful punishments, scourging with rods or whips, and exempted him from crucifixion. A Roman could not be crucified. A Roman could not be scourged without a hearing. No wonder then, you get to verse 29 and you see the Kiliarch's quandary. Verse 29, then straightway. What does the word straightway mean? Immediately. I love this. Immediately, the ones who are about to examine him, get out of there. Why? This is a Roman. The chief captain was also afraid. The Kiliarch was also afraid. He's no longer afraid of the mob. He's not afraid of Paul. He's afraid of what he has done. After he knew, and the sense of that word "know" is the same word, after he knew for certain that he was a Roman and because he had bound him. He knows for certain that Paul is a Roman. This changes how they treat Paul from here to the end of the book of Acts. Yeah, have you ever gone to the book of Acts and noticed how they treat him courteously? He's a Roman. Folks, we have, by the providence of God, all kinds of freedoms in America. And you'll find that you're treated in a different way if you ever go around the world, throughout the world. The stronger our nation is, the more respect people have for you. You can use that liberty and that respect that you gain from this world for yourself, or you can use it to God's glory and say that God gave me this right to live in this country. God gave me this privilege to have these rights. You have the freedom. You have the freedom to give the gospel. And I wonder sometimes if the reason our freedoms are in jeopardy is because we're not using them to do what God has particularly commissioned us to do. Verse 30, as we see what the Kiliarch would know for certain, he still needs to know, why is Paul being accused? By the providence of God, even before Paul had been born, get this, God had been providing for his protection. Because God saw way ahead. Does the fact that God knows who's going to be saved, does that bother you? Why should it? Because then, whether I want to be saved or not, I get saved. Nope. It's your choice. God, by his providence, had protected Paul from the crowd using the soldiers. And then he protected him from the Kiliarch, from having him examined. And then that changes protection by the Kiliarch, via the Roman citizenship that Paul, enjoys to protect Paul. Why? Because Paul has been obeying his commission from God, a commission he had just mentioned in Aramaic to this Jewish mob. And throughout the book of Acts, you're going to see, look at chapter 23, look at verse 11, where again, providentially, God says, Paul, be of good cheer, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also in Rome. You're protected, Paul. You're protected. Go to chapter 27. He's on a ship. The ship is going to crash. The ship is going to sink. But Paul gives this testimony in chapter 27 and verse 24. Verse 23 says, there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Paul, you're going to stand before Caesar. Every man is immortal until God chooses to take him. Amen. And he is immortal. And yet he doesn't use that for himself. He uses it for God. And I think of this. When God says you're going to stand before Caesar, in fulfillment of what God had told Ananias when he tried to get Ananias to go to Paul in chapter 9. And God had said to Ananias, he will stand before kings. And indeed he does. He stands before the Sanhedrin in chapter 23, before Felix in chapter 24, before Festus in 25, before King Agrippa in chapter 26, and he's in Rome in chapter 28, before Nero, perhaps. Months earlier, he had said, I must also see Rome, Acts 19, 21. He got to Rome, all right. As somebody said, all expenses paid by the Romans. We know it was via the providence of God. As with Paul, God will providentially care for you and me as we obey the particular commission God has given us. God will take care of you. Amen. God will take care of us. Lord,